This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
With all your heart, with all natural, and with all your life, with all
Meridecho, and with all your possessions. Rashi says on V'chol Nafshecho, Afilu hu noitel es Nafshecho, even if he is taking your life, you should love him at that moment. The Gemara says in Brochus Daf Samech Aleph, B'shor shehitziu es Rabbi Akiva lahariga, that at the time that they took Rabbi Akiva out to be killed, Zman Kriyashmo Haya. It was the time of Kriyashma. V'ho yusokim es besoroi b'masriku shel barza. And they were combing his flesh with iron combs. One can picture the situation. Rabbi Akiva, used to large followings, used to a tremendous amount of kovod and dignity. Can you imagine how Rabbi Akiva was treated wherever he went? Finding himself cast onto the floor of some prison cell in the hands of arrogant, despicable, low-down Romans who were taking great pleasure in every moment of his humiliation and in every moment of his suffering. And there he is in the midst of this dirt and this filth and these laughing and mocking policemen and officers, combing his flesh with combs of iron, and as they combed, so the blood was running. And he was busy saying, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Omru loy Talmidov. His Talmidim said to him, Rabbeinu Ad Kan, Rebbe, to this point, so far. Omar Lahem, he said to them, Kol yomai hayisi mitztayer al posuk zeh. All my life I've been upset about this posuk, v'chol nafshecho. That you shall love Hashem with all your life, and which means afilu noitel es nishmosecho, even if he's taking your life. Omarti, I said, mosai yovu liyodai v'akaymenu. When will I be able to achieve this? When will this come my way so that I can fulfill it? Ve'achshav shebo liyodi lo akaymenu. And now that it has come my way, will I not perform it? So answers Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Leib Chasman asks a very important question. He says, what kind of a mitzvah is this? Is this love? The Torah is telling us the ultimate of love. Afilu noitel es nafshecho. What kind of love is this? It on the surface appears Chas v'sholem a little bit like Christian love, like turning the other cheek, and where do you find such a thing? Somebody comes and kills you must love him, throw your arms around him. We say, if somebody comes to kill you, you kill him first, get him. That's not a time for love, that's a time for anger, that's a time for aggression. And here we're told the ultimate of the ahavto, the ultimate of love is b'chol nafshecho. Afilu noitel es nishmosecho, even if he's taking your life at that time, to love him, that's the ultimate. And Rabbi Akiva says, all my life I've been waiting to fulfill this mitzvah. And does it mean that until one actually dies, giving one's life al kiddush Hashem, that one is not fulfilling this mitzvah of the ahavto Hashem v'kecho b'chol levavcho b'chol nafshecho? The Rosh says in Orchus Chaim, there's a mitzvah le'ahiv es Hashem b'chol levavcho b'chol nafshecho b'chol meidecho. There's a mitzvah to love the Ribbono shel Olam with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. V'tachshoiv be'omrecho es Hashem elokecho, and you should think when you say Hashem elokecho, and so on. Limsor gufcho u'mamoincho al kudushosoi, that I am prepared to give my life and my possessions for kiddush Hashem. And it implies in the Rosh that that's how one fulfills the mitzvah, by saying it with such kavona, with such intention, that I say, as I'm saying this, I say to myself, should it chas v'sholem be necessary, I'll do it. Everything I have, I'll give to the Ribbono shel Olam if necessary, including my life. But on the surface, it appears that without Am Yotze, that's the best I'm expected to do. I'm not expected to go and give my life unless it comes to that. But Rabbi Akiva implies that he was unfulfilled until he gave his life. He wanted this, he pleaded for this, he waited for this moment. Why so? That's the Blade Chasman's kashi. The Blade Chasman gives an answer, which is very deep and very beautiful. You can have two people standing in a queue at the airport with their suitcases, waiting to check in on a flight to London. And one man has a grin from ear to ear, and he's happy, and the other man has got a long sour face. And you go up to the man with a long sour face, and you say, you look a little bit miserable, what would you do? Flying again, standing in these queues, airports, aeroplanes, sitting for hours. You know what it's like? And they eventually get through, and there's another queue then to go through the immigration. There you've got the two of them again, standing in the long queue, waiting. One of them muttering under his breath, and the other one as happy as the day is long. They go through further, wait again. Finally their flight is called, then their flight is delayed, then it's called, then it's delayed. It's waiting and waiting. The one is grinning from ear to ear, and the other one's getting more and more upset. And then they get on, and the plane is packed, and it's full, and there's no kosher food for either of them. And the one's grinning from ear to ear, and the other one is getting furious. And at the end of the there's nothing to eat, so the one goes to sleep peacefully, and the other one can't sleep, and he's pacing up and down, and he has a drink and another drink, and he smokes. He can't take it anymore. And they get to the other end, and there's a delay, and they have to circle because there's fog, and it takes them hours. Eventually they come down and queues again. They stand in line, they have problems with customs, with visas. Again they have to stand for their suitcases, and the hours they have to wait and wait for their suitcases. Their suitcases get lost. The one's grinning from ear to ear, and the other one's miserable. Eventually we watch these two passengers, and we want to know, what is the secret of the one that's grinning? All these tzoros that he suffered. He suffered exactly the same tzoros as the other man. Yet he's calm and collected and happy. What's his secret? And we go up to him, while he's waiting for his suitcases at London Airport, and we say, Rabbi, you look so calm, you look so happy, you've had a rough time. Rough time, he says. Do you know where I'm going? I'm being knighted tomorrow. I've been invited to London. The Queen's knighting me. Well, stay a little bit longer. The suitcase gets, it doesn't matter. A person's tzoros cannot be measured quantitatively. How we cope with tzoros depends on the value of those tzoros. The businessman, we say, where are you going? Oh, to another meeting. And I know it's likely to be as unsuccessful as the first one. That explains it. The one sees himself on a meaningless mission, and every mishap becomes serious and exaggerated, and the other one sees himself as going on something valuable and purposeful, and the mishaps become very small and insignificant. The essence of hypochondria is a person who has nothing to live for. A person who has nothing to live for, every little pain becomes a major issue. It freezes him, it stills him, he can't operate at all. Why? You find somebody else who's active and busy and doing things. You'll find sometimes two elderly people, same age, same conditions. And the one's active and popular and speaks with people and is social and is involved. And the other one sits in a rocking chair all day and oy vey and oy and oy vey and a cramp here, this hurts here. And so. That's all. But what about the other one? The one's living for something, the other one isn't, that's all. Not that the one has more suffering than the other. Everybody has the same suffering. Let nobody think that anybody suffers more than anybody else. The Ribbono Shel Olam dishes it out very fairly and very equally. Where we differ is in how we cope with our suffering. That's the only difference. We live in a society that tends to cope with discomfort by endeavoring to eliminate the discomfort. We try and make ourselves comfortable. It doesn't help. That's not the way to handle discomfort. The way to handle discomfort is to inject meaning into one's life so that the discomfort becomes irrelevant. To remove the discomfort is impossible. You remove one discomfort and another one appears. So you eventually give a person, he wants a bigger house, you give him the bigger house. He wants another motor car, he gets another motor car. He wants a swimming pool, he gets a swimming pool. And his children are on drugs. What have you achieved? So somebody else's children are not in drugs, so he doesn't have the house and the swimming pool, and that's what's bothering him. Whatever you want, each one has their tzoras. One cannot eliminate tzoras by trying to remove them. One can only de-emphasize them. One can obliterate them by filling a vacuum of a life with purposefulness, so that the tzoras become meaningful and they become valuable. But it goes further. Normally, we tend to believe that when A loves B, A gives to B. That's one of the expressions of his love. But we find in Halachas, as Reb Leib Chassaman, an interesting phenomenon. The din is that when a man marries a woman, he has to give her at least a shove pruto. He has to give her an object which is at worth at least a pruto, which is the lowest definable form of currency, coin of currency that existed at that time. And that forms the kinyan, that forms the act of acquisition. And after that, she becomes his wife. But it can be reversed. If the man is a very, very important man, if the man is a prince, if the man is very choshu, and she gives him the ring, and his acceptance of that present, of that ring, is worth at least a pruto to her, then that also is considered an act of acquisition. He has given her the worth of a pruto by accepting her gift. There was recently a lot of discussion in the newspaper about the correctness of Princess Diana accepting a gift from a certain admirer, and she had to give it back. There's too much tovas hanor, there's too much benefit to the giver when an odom choshuv receives. And an odom choshuv, a king and a prince and a president, has to be very careful what gifts he receives. Because by receiving a gift, he's dishing out a favor. And he's got to be careful. He can be accused of favoritism and all sorts of funny things. He can't just accept any gift. There are very meticulous rules that govern what gifts he can properly accept and what gifts he cannot accept. Because for an odom choshuv to accept a gift, for an important man to accept a gift, he gives to the giver something of greater value than the gift itself. And so if the choson receives the ring from a kala, if the choson is a prince, if he's a great man, and the mere acceptance of it is worth a pruto to the kala, it is as if he, by accepting the ring, has given her the worth of a pruto in the pleasure of having had the ring accepted. And therefore, says Reb Leib Chassaman, we see situations where it's exactly the reverse. Where the receiver is the giver and the giver is the receiver. The one who gives the gift is in fact receiving more than the value of the gift. And the one who receives the gift is in fact giving more than the value of what is received. And that perhaps is the essence of the solution to hypochondria. Hypochondria is the exaggeration of tzoras. It's difficult to when one talks about norms in these things, it's very difficult. A person has a headache. So he thinks to himself, this is my situation, this is my condition, I have a headache, I can't concentrate, I can't learn, I can't study. So he takes a pill. The headache goes away. Usually he doesn't start learning then, usually the pill puts him to sleep in any case. Be that as it may. He thinks he's solved the problem, he hasn't really. There's another solution to the problem. I'm talking about a violent migraine, he has a headache. He sits down and says, headaches, everybody's got something sometime, and as one gets older, one gets more and more. If I'm going to stop learning every time my head hurts, what am I going to do with myself? So he sits down and he opens his Gemara and he starts learning. All of a sudden he gets involved in a sugya with Gzera Shovas and Tosfos and backwards and forwards, and his headache's finished, gone. So what's the real situation? What's the norm? Does he have a headache or doesn't he have a headache? You can't tell. As you reduce the meaning of what you're doing, so the pain and suffering increases. As you increase the meaning of what you're doing, so the pain and suffering decreases. Pain and suffering is merely a ratio, a relationship between the meaning of what one is doing and the cost of doing it. Life costs. It requires energy. It requires effort. So Mesillas Yesharim told us, you will remember in the beginning, in his first Perek, how this world is an oilam of nisunus. It's a world of trouble. It's a world of difficulty. It's a world of effort. It's a world of suffering. There are very few people that live their lives through without tremendous sacrifice and without tremendous effort and energy, and surely that can't be the purpose of life. So one finds that there's a cost to living in this world. To what degree that cost hurts one depends what you're getting back. A shulach comes to one and says, I want 1,000 rand from you. Decide, no, you'll give the 1,000 rand, but it hurts like anything. Carries on for certain people and carries on hurting for a long time. He's given 1,000 rand, what's he got back? Nothing. It's almost as hurtful to him as losing the 1,000 rand. One puts it on the stock exchange and loses it. It's very, very hurtful. It's gone. I paid, I put in effort, I put in the work of the fruit of my labors. How long did I have to work to earn this extra 1,000 rand that I don't need for my day to day living, and it's gone? And what did I get? Nothing. But if he takes 1,000 rand and he buys a mitzvah, he goes to an auction and he picks up a work of art which is worth 5,000 rand, he comes back satisfied. What happened to all those months and all that effort and energy that went into producing the 1,000 rand that you paid for the picture? Doesn't matter. Look what I got back. That's the nachas. And when the nachas exceeds the effort, the tzoras go. It's as simple as that. And so in every act of giving, if one is able to get more than one gives, one doesn't feel the giving at all. It doesn't hurt. If one is giving more than one gets, then it does hurt a little bit. When one gives to the Ribbono Shel Olam, one has to see oneself as giving to the Melech Malchei Hamlochim. One's not talking about a little prince. One's not talking about a king, not even of kings as they used to be in days gone by. One's talking about Melech Malchei Hamlochim, the King of Kings. One is given a gift to, and he has accepted it. There's no greater hanor, there's no greater nachas than that. It depends also how free we are in the way we receive things. Normally, when we receive sacrifices, we receive them graciously. If somebody makes a sacrifice for us, we don't turn it down. It takes great stature to be able to turn down the sacrifice. A person who's worked all his life and planned and plotted for 20 years to produce something for you, and afterwards he comes and he says, I want you to know, I've worked for 20 years for this for you, I've made it, I've wanted to give it to you, please accept it. So, no, thank you, I can't. That takes great courage and that takes great stature. But it's that which makes the gift worthwhile for the person who gives it. If you receive gifts from everybody equally easily, then there's nothing special in the whole business. I think I've mentioned to you that it's happened to me only very occasionally where when one has offered some money to a Rosh Yeshiva and he's accepted it, one feels very relieved, because he doesn't accept from everybody. He wants to be absolutely sure that the money is kosher. And the same as he wouldn't receive food from anybody unless he knew what home it came from and what kitchen it was prepared in and the Yerushalayim of the person that made it and his standard of kashrus. So he's not going to accept money from everybody. He wants to know about his Shmir Shabbos, and he wants to know about his observance of the laws of Choshen Mishpat, of the business laws. He's not going to accept from everybody. And he makes inquiries before he accepts. You want to give him, he doesn't take. Thank you. Yeah. Meanwhile, he makes a few inquiries. You have to come and see him a second time and a third time. And eventually, yeah, accepts it. You feel as if you just passed an examination. And it doesn't hurt. The act of giving doesn't hurt. Because he's done you, because of his discernment in whom he accepts from, he has done you a far greater honor than what it's cost you. You've passed an examination, he's tested you, and he's satisfied with you. That's a worthwhile kind of gift. That's something special. If you take your child to a yeshiva, or to a school, or to any institution of learning, and before you walk through the door, the principal's already out with his, he wants to register the child already. That's one way of doing it. There's another way where you come in and the principal says, sorry, we're full up. Full up. Even one child you can't take. This is an exceptional child I would still take. But sorry, we're full. And you start and you argue and you plead, and the principal makes inquiries about your background and the child's background and who he is and what he is, and you come again and again, and after 5 visits, finally, the principal says, no, you know what? I'm happy to take your child. It's a pleasure. You've raised the whole status of that act. You've raised the whole level and the whole status of the acceptance of the institution, of the value of the learning, of the value of that acceptance. we're so eager to take, we're so eager to accept, that we spoil the whole interrelationship of give and take by making it too free. The man walks up to a woman and says, I would like you to marry me. And she says, fine, pleasure. And he's a bit taken aback. And he says, is that the first time that you've been proposed to? She says, no, I've been proposed to 10 times before. He says, what happened? Did you accept? Did you not accept? Sure, I accepted, the same as I accepted now. He pulled out last minute. You can be quite sure number 11 is going to pull out too. What kind of girl is this? What is it? If he hears that 10 people have proposed to her and she's turned them all down, and he tries and she turns him down as well, and he tries again because he thinks it's worthwhile and she turns him down again, now it's becoming interesting, now it's becoming attractive. This is not a poshita girl, this is somebody who considers herself of value. She's not prepared to take anybody. When she finally takes, it will be with checking and with going into background and with being satisfied that this is Taka, a person of the stature whom she's prepared to share her life with. And when she finally says yes, he feels relieved. He's got more than he's giving. And that should be in every interrelationship. After I've given, there should be a feeling that I've received more than I've given. And then all the tzoras involved in the act of giving, all the tzoras of life melt into insignificance. They become beautiful and they become lovely. Last Friday night we had a Sholem Zocher in the community. One of the reasons, the backgrounds that the Taz brings for a Sholem Zocher is a Medrash in Emor, where for a korban we're told v'hoyo shivas yomim tachas imoy. An animal has to be 8 days old before you bring it as a korban. Why? Says the Medrash. Moshol lemelech shenichnas limedina. This can be compared to a king who comes into a province. The gozar ve'omar, and he decrees and says, kol achsanoim shiyesh kan. All the guests who come to the party, who come to the ball this evening, lo yiru ponai ad shiyiru ponai hamatrun tchil, will not see my face until they've been received by the queen first. Kach omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lo yitoviyu lefonai korban. So said Hashem Yisborach, don't bring a korban, don't bring a sacrifice to me, ad shetavir olav Shabbos, until it's lived for a Shabbos, until it has experienced the Shabbos. I'm not prepared to accept a sacrifice that hasn't seen a Shabbos. She'ein zayin yomim below Shabbos. There's no 7 days without a Shabbos. Ve'ein milah below Shabbos, and there's no bris milah without a Shabbos. Somebody asked, the Rav recently asked me, he had to explain to somebody why we have Sholem Zochers and we don't have Sholem Nekevers. Although Micha told me that in America nowadays they have Sholem Nekevers as well. But the reason is very simple. It's for the same reasons we have a bris for a Zocher. Maybe in America they have bris for Nekevers as well now. I don't know. But here we don't yet do that. And the two are tied together. The Sholem Zocher is for the bris, to celebrate that Shabbos which the child has to experience before the Ribbono Shel Olam will accept the Korban. Why don't we get feribled? My goodness, Ribbono Shel Olam, my child's giving his blood for you. What are you telling me? Give it a Shabbos first. I won't accept it yet. Who's asking you? I'm giving to you. Francis, 1 second. Do you think I'll take from anybody? Do you think I'll take anything? I'm that desperate that I need your korban. First let the child have a Shabbos, then bring the child to me. I'm not in such a rush. So with every sacrifice and with every korban, first let the sacrifice go through a Shabbos. It's not ready for me yet. We're not used to that way of thinking. We expect that when we come with our check, we expect the Rosh Hashiva to have his hand out already. Because that's become the way that things are done nowadays. But that isn't the way that the Torah wants things done. Come with your check signed, you'll have to go through cross-examination before you'll accept it. Not so simple. Has it had a Shabbos? Is it kosher? Does this check have some stature to it? Does it have some background to it? Does it have some meaning to it? When the yeshiva was going up in Kfar Chassidim, and they were very, very desperate. The Beis HaMedrash was a room not much bigger than these two rooms here. It was a little hut made from Masonite, and it had been that way for a long time. It had 140 boys learning in it for 18, 19 hours a day. Can you imagine 140 boys sitting in this kind of area? The shiurim took place in there. That's all there was. There was no other place. The shiurim were there, the seder hayoyim was there, the davening was there, everything was there. In the rain, the water used to come through the roof. In the summer, it was boiling hot. There was no air conditioning, there was no heating, nothing. They needed to build, they had no money. And the Nesher cement company, which was just down the road, one could see it from the yeshiva, offered to supply the cement free of charge. And the administrators of the yeshiva were very happy. At last they would be able to get busy with a respectable building. And my great uncle Rebbe Elia said, no, that factory I see smoking away on Shabbos. I'm not having the Beis HaMedrash built while it's cement that's made in a factory that works on Shabbos. So we'll go without the Beis HaMedrash for a little bit longer. Not that eager. The cement also has to have some stature to it. We're not that desperate to take whatever comes. It's a different attitude to fundraising. It's a different attitude to collecting, to receiving, to taking. Not that desperate. When it's right, it will come. So says the Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm not that desperate for your korbanos, and I'm not that desperate for your children. First the Shabbos. So they're not ready yet. Wait. And so in the shita it followed too, I guess. When I very much wanted to go to Kfar Chassidim and to sit in the shir of my late Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal, and I wrote to him and said that I was coming, took it for granted he would receive me with open hands, and he said, no, you can come, but you're not ready for my shir yet. And pleading, and what Mesiras Nefesh, and I'll stay in your shir for as long as you want me to stay there. No. In that case, I said, I'm not willing to go into the shir below yours, because I wasn't the person giving that shir wasn't along the style that I wanted to learn. So I said, if I don't come into your shir, that means I'll go to another yeshiva, and the chances are I'll stay there. Go to Gateshead. He said, very well, it's a good idea. Why don't you go? And then the correspondence started later. Am I ready yet? Not yet. Wait. Until it came, yes, now you can come. Give status to it. Give stature. You know it's a value. You know you've passed the test. You know he's thought about it. Not that eager. Prepared to manage without you a little bit of time. And if that means that I lose you altogether, good, there are plenty of others. Doesn't matter. And if there are nobody, no others, we'll close up. Doesn't matter. Not that desperate. This attitude of the receiver not being that desperate is of primary importance in the interrelationship between people. And all them says nefesh to get there eventually, and the year that I had to go through of preparation to get into that shir, all that effort and all that energy, it was as sweet as anything. It was nothing. Because you're working for something which is worthwhile. You're working for something you know you cannot achieve any other way. There is no alternative. This is the route. The man who's standing in the queue with his two suitcases knows there's no other way to get to London. If I want my knighthood, this is what I have to do. And it doesn't bother him at all. Nothing. It's worthwhile. The man standing next to him is going through the same sorrows. One would expect him to be suffering just as much. He can't take it. Because he's going through those sorrows and he doesn't know what for. One can find two patients in a hospital suffering from the same disease, given the same bleak chances by the doctors. One pulls through and the other doesn't. It's very often not for medical reasons. It's very often simply because the one has something to live for and the other doesn't. The one has decided that his sorrows can be overcome and that it's worthwhile going through all this and it's worthwhile coming through all of it and getting healthy again. And the other's given up already. Nothing to live for. Whose tzoros are greater? Neither of them have tzoros. Both of them have tzoros. But tzoros are measured simply in how much meaning and value is injected into their lives, not in how big the tzoros are. When the Torah says, "Ahavto es Hashem elokecha b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha," that you've got to love the Ribbono Shel Olam with all your life, that means that the level of Ahavo has to reach such a point where you want him to take your life as well. Everything I've got I want to give to you. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, no, the Chai Bohem. You live by the Torah, I don't want your life. I want you to live. And there's a chance you think I've shown a Shabbos, I've got to transgress the Shabbos, otherwise I'll die. So maybe I should give my life. Maybe this is my opportunity, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, I don't need your life. Transgress the Shabbos. Live. Not important. The Chai Bohem, it's important that you live. I don't need you to give your life yet. Until there comes a time where there's a Kiddush Hashem at stake, where it's one of those few occasions that a person has to give his life, to want to do that as well. because that is the ultimate of pleasure, to give our greatest possession to the Ribbono Shel Olam and have him receive it. That's the greatest pleasure of all. His hand's not out waiting. If his hand were out waiting, there would be no pleasure in it. His hand is not out waiting. He's very selective who he gives this honor to, the right, the privilege of giving their life al Kiddush Hashem. Not everybody gets that opportunity. And so Reb Leib Chassman explains the Gemara. Omru lo Talmido, of his Talmidim, said to him, Rabbeinu, Ad Kai, our Rebbe, is it possible for a human being to reach such heights? That's their kashya. What does it mean, Ad Kai? Are they asking, are you expected to go this far? They know you're expected. There's a Mefurish Pasuk with a Chazal on it. Even if he's taking your life, you've got to love him. We know that. What's their question? Explains Reb Leib Chassman. The question is, Ad Kan, is it possible for a human being to reach such levels? And if so, how? How does one reach a level where you can be standing in a situation of total humiliation, in extremely excruciating pain and suffering, about to face your end, and you're calmly saying Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, as if you're standing in shul on Yom Kippur? Is that possible? How do you achieve it? Amar lohem, and he tells them the secret. Kol yomai hoyisi mitztayer al posuk ze bechol nafshecha afilu noiteles nishmosecha. I had sorrows in my life, says Rabbi Akiva. Oh, we know what sorrows Rabbi Akiva had in his life. And we'd expect him to go on. Kol yomai yisi mitztayer, my whole life I had sorrows. Oh, let's hear Rabbi Akiva's sorrows. He's standing about to die, and he's going to tell us of his sorrows. And he can only recall one suffering, one sorrow he can recall. The suffering of not having been able to perform this one mitzvah properly. That's all he remembers suffering. Every time he said Kriya Shema, wondering, will he ever be able to have that opportunity? We often say Kriya Shema, and we know what we're supposed to say, and we say B'chol Nafshecha, and with all our life. But we stick in parenthesis, Chas V'Sholom. That's all. No doubt we'll give our lives to the Ribbono Shel Olam as well. We put in there, and God forbid, rather let us not be put in that situation. Says Rabbi Akiva, that's where you'll never get there. I had sorrows my whole life. Every time I said Kriya Shema, I had sorrows. Why aren't I being given this privilege? Why is the Ribbono Shel Olam not accepting my life? So much, so dedicated have I been to wanting to go the whole way. And even to the point of giving my life. One isn't allowed to do it. One isn't allowed to put oneself into a situation like that. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, no thank you. Don't bring me donations. I don't want it. When I want it, I'll tell you. And he hasn't told me. He doesn't want me. That's been my tzora, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. When one goes around wondering, is the Rosh Hashiva going to accept my donation or not? And that's the sleepless night you're having. Not, can I really afford to give it to him? It just changes the emphasis. The one you're thinking, I'm going to go and give a donation tomorrow, and you're thinking, I'm going to give 200 rand, can I manage? Can I afford it? What am I going to have to go without for that 200 rand? Oops, I promised him I will do it, but how? What's going to be at the end of the month? Will I manage? And you toss and you turn in bed and you suffer. And the next day you go and you're drained and you're tired and you're giving your 200 rand and he writes you a receipt and off you go. And you feel tired and drained still. And the other, you're also lying awake at night. But you're not worrying about where does the 200 rand come from. You're just worried about one thing, is he going to accept it or not? What am I going to do if he gives it back to me? He says, no, thank you. There'll be nothing worse than that. How will I suffer such an indignation, such a humiliation, such a failure? And so one tosses and turns in bed, and one worries, and one sweats, and one goes trembling and shaking the next morning with one's little check in one's hand, and one gives it to him, and one watches and waits. And he acknowledges and thanks, writes out a receipt, and you feel this load off your shoulders. The same action, the same sacrifice, the same solace. The one you feel relieved, and the other you feel drained. The difference? He didn't have his hand out, and the other one did. That's the difference. The tzoreh, the tzar, the pain and suffering that one is meant to suffer, is the pain of wondering how to have one's contribution to society, to the world, to the Ribbono Shel Olam accepted. How to do it in the best way. How to do it in the most correct way. How to do it in an elevating way. That's the Torah one has. Not the Torah of the energy and the effort that it takes to actually do the deed. And with that we find the solution to what I call the hypochondria of materialism. That Western society is so void of meaning to life that of course it can't cope with its own suffering. It can't cope with its own miseries. It's quite odd, in fact, that the world is currently so preoccupied with the bottom tip of Africa. The whole world. University, professors, students, politicians, kings, presidents, leaders, businessmen. The whole world occupied with a little country at the bottom of Africa. What does it show? That we have major problems here? We do have major problems here. But they're not world problems. They're not international problems. They're major national problems, as many countries have at the moment. Of course we have problems that need to be sorted out. But they're not international problems. So when a person's toe is sore, does his head stop operating? Yes, if there's nothing else in his head does stop operating. His toe, his sore toe becomes so powerful, and it festers and it hurts, that he can't do anything. And he goes hopping around and jumping and complaining and moaning, and there's nothing he can think about except his sore toe. Only because his head is empty. The tragedy of what's happening at the moment, not from a South African point of view, it's a different thing, from an international point of view, is that the world has nothing better to think about and to worry about than what's happening in the bottom tip of Africa. Not that it should be of no concern of theirs. Sure, it should be of some concern. The world is interdependent. Countries lean on one another and need one another. And certainly what happens in one country is the business of another country. Certainly if my toe is sore, I might have to go to the doctor or put on a plaster or do something. I don't say that one must ignore it totally. But that should become the total of obsession of one's thinking. That's a sickness. That's hypochondria. That means I have nothing more important. My mind is empty. I'm bankrupt. That's what it means. And just as it is so on national and international levels, so it is on communal levels and on social levels. You'll find very often institutions, all they're worried about is what other institutions are doing. Forget about it. Every little thing becomes a major issue. Every little problem, every little mishap, which inevitably happens when people are rubbing shoulders together. Of course things happen. Somebody gets hurt by mistake, sometimes deliberately. Somebody gets left out. Somebody gets elevated over somebody else's head. All these things happen. But they need to be dealt with in proportion. And yet you'll find they become the talking point, and they become the focal point, and everything revolves around this all of a sudden, and gets blown up out of all proportion. What does that mean, that the problem is big? No! It means that there's nothing bigger in one's mind. That's all it means. The bigness of a problem or the bigness of a sorrow can only be measured against what else occupies one's mind. There's no other way to measure it. You can only say it's the biggest thing in my mind, or it's the smallest thing in my mind, or it's fairly big in my mind. But one can't say it's big or it's small against what. Is it big or small? And so it is also with individuals. One goes through a difficult time. Everybody goes through a difficult time most of their lives, in one form or another. Everybody's facing problems and facing difficulties and facing challenges. Sometimes it's health, sometimes it's wealth, sometimes it's social, sometimes it's family, sometimes it's intellectual, sometimes it's academic. It's always something that bothers a person. How big the tzora is can only be measured in terms of what else one has in one's mind. If a man has nothing in his mind but his business, and things go bad in business, that's a major tzora. His life is collapsing. If a man has nothing in his life but his children, and his children are giving him trouble, that's a major problem. That's his whole life. But if a man's life is rich and he has many things, and he has his business and he has his family and he has his learning and he has his friends, and he has his various other activities and involvements, a tzora in one does not yet mean the end of the world. A tzora in one gets pushed aside a little bit. It gets dealt with just as one little aspect that needs attention, but not as a major issue. Just as it happens in health. that when one finds that one is suffering a pain in one or another part of one's body, the degree to which that slows one down is not measured by how big the pain is, but how much else there is to occupy one's mind. And that's why the Gemara gives in fact the whole recipe of what to do with pains in different parts of your body. And one is taka, if you've got a headache, sit and learn. The remedies are all non-medical. There are ways of handling these things. We're not talking obviously where there's a clinical problem that needs attention. We're talking only with coping with the suffering of pain and with the suffering of that kind of pain which you can't do anything about. Certainly if a person has a problem which needs medical attention, that needs to be attended to, but while it's being attended to, he doesn't have to occupy his mind with it all day and all night. One of the eighth wonder of the world at the moment, perhaps the ninth, South Africa seems to occupy the attention of the press a great deal at the moment, and the other thing which seems to occupy the attention of the press a great deal at the moment are the intestines of President Reagan. One gets an idea of how busy the world is, what they've really got to think of, and how occupied they are in grave matters. The tip of Africa and the tummy of President Reagan, these are the things that are bothering them. Television coverage, front page magazines, articles, diagrams, pictures of what his tummy looks like, what it looked like before and what it looks like after and what it's going to look like and what it used to look like. Who's interested what his tummy looks like? But that's where we're holding hypochondria. The world is a hypochondriac, and one of its leaders has a tummy ache, and we're all obsessed now with his tummy ache and with a toe-ache at the tip of Africa. Those are the two things that are affecting us. And why has the world been so moved by it? Why has it become such an incredible thing? Because the only person in the world who hasn't been that moved, incidentally, on neither score, he's neither terribly concerned about the tip of Africa, nor is he terribly concerned about his own stomach, is the man himself. He goes to work, he's smiling away, he carries on as normal, he's not particularly interested in sanctions or schmanctions, he's got a country to run, he's got other things to do. The rest of the world is busy. One man in the Western world has his mind occupied with things bigger than his own tummy and the tip of Africa. That's where we've got to. And that's why it's captured the imagination of the world. Realizing their own inadequacy, they look up in admiration to a sick man who ignores his sickness and carries on as usual. We tend to look upon it and say, is that love that we have to give our lives and we have to be combed by combs of iron? Is that how you love the Ribono Shel Olam? Is that what he wants from us? The answer is no, he doesn't want that from you. All he wants is your craving to give that to him. He dafka doesn't want it. And it's because he doesn't want it that you should crave all the more to give it to him. And if in a situation one finds oneself where one does have to give it to him, you should know that one should be able to quietly say Kriya Shema, to engage in dialogue with one's Talmidim, to learn the Parsha, what's Pshat in Bechol Levavcho, Bechol Nafshecho, how all my life. Look at the dialogue that's going on. The man is being tortured, and he's sitting with his Talmidim and discussing clinically and analytically his emotions, his feelings, what he did feel like, what he does feel like, learning the Parsha, saying Kriya Shema. That one can do if what one is giving is worth less than what one is receiving. And the fact that he looks up and he sees the Ribono Shel Olam stand before him, accepting this great sacrifice graciously, finally accepting it from him, your life is worthy, Rabbi Akiva, I'm willing to take it, that gives him such nachas and such joy that the pain of the combs of iron are completely obliterated in the pleasure of his Mesiras Nefesh.